Welcome to Observations. We have Kirk and Jason and Scott here with us today. We're going to begin today picking up where we left off in our last program with a review of Psalm 91. For those who are new to listening to this program, Psalm 91 is how this all began for me about a decade, in fact, a little over a decade now, 15 years ago, when the 19 Muslims decided that they would do the ultimate suicide bombing and fly planes into two buildings in New York and one in Washington, D.C. And at the time, the nation was making every excuse they could for Islam, saying that these terrorists had corrupted their religion as opposed to the religion having corrupted them. The line is still being dispensed with reckless abandon in the liberal media.
According to George Bush at the time, he said that they blaspheme the name of Allah.
Oh, yeah, well, George Bush would be a real expert because he was the ultimate scoundrel. A man that claimed to be a Christian simply so that he could get elected. The moment he was no longer elected, he renounced all of that. Not that it would have made him any better to have been a Christian. Look at Ted Cruz and his constant array of dishonest dealings. The reality is that God hates religion. He hates all religion. There are no good religions. And Islam just happens to be the most overtly satanic of all religions. And there's 1.4 to 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. So God wanted the religion exposed and condemned. He wanted it to be made absolutely clear that Allah was modeled after Satan. Now, you can't blaspheme Satan. He is the adversary. Allahu Akbar is his ultimate fantasy, to be considered as greater than, older than, bigger than Yahweh, which is why the phrase was first conceived at the raid of Kabar. So when I was asked to expose and condemn Islam some 15 years ago, happened to be on Tarua in 2001. The challenge, of course, was that no one has been successful in surviving doing that sort of thing because Muslims respond with reckless abandon. Matter of fact, even today there was news of an imam in England praising a Muslim in Pakistan. A Muslim in Pakistan had been hired and trained by the military to guard a politician who had come to the conclusion that the blaspheme laws in Pakistan were way too repressive. If you say anything critical of Muhammad or Allah or Islam, you're sentenced to death. And so his bodyguard killed him, putting, I think it was 41 bullets into his body while he was shopping at a marketplace. This is a rather deadly religion. Muhammad was a mass murderer. He was a ruthless terrorist. And so my immediate response to God when asked to expose and condemn it beyond I'm not qualified, and if we're going to do this, we're going to have to do it together because I'm not qualified to do it. And second, since they have a tendency to kill anyone who exposes the true nature of their religion and God, I am I'm here to say that you're going to need to protect my house. My home and family has to be a safe sanctuary. And number three, so that I don't rely on any of my own devices, since marketing was my primary skill set, I'm not going to market this. Whatever interviews, whatever notoriety this book and this message gets, going to be totally up to you. Well, now I have done 5,000 hours of talk radio. I think Yahweh has done a pretty fair job. And since I have never ducked for cover, never been physically attacked, even though I've received thousands of death threats, my home has indeed been a safe sanctuary. As for working together, well, You can read Prophet of Doom. It's free online at prophetofdoom.net, and you can ascertain for yourself if it is a work that was that does the job of exposing and condemning Islam using Muhammad's own words and deeds. But as for that work, it immediately transitioned into Yada Yah, the seven volumes of Yada Yah, to Questioning Paul, to An Introduction to God, and now Observations for Our Time. So when I was asked to do this, and I negotiated with God, the answer to the negotiation was in my right-hand pocket. It was the 91st Psalm, and it begins, "He who dwells, inhabits, and lives restored. He who approaches and remains, settles and established in his dwelling. Within the protected place, which is carefully concealed for sight, inside the refuge and safe haven, the sanctuary, even the garment of Elyon, the Almighty, so as to be withdrawn, ascending to meet the light, and going up to visit the awe-inspiring while gaining status and splendor, in the shadow and resulting image, and therefore in the likeness and resemblance, as a copy or near duplicate, created by the light in one less dimension, as a result of being submerged in the protection and the successful empowerment, the prosperity of the Mighty One, the most expansive, capable, and influential one, with the ability to cultivate, to nourish, and to bless life. He will continually abide, dwelling for an extended period of time, remaining during the night. And he will lodge and live on an ongoing basis and therefore endure through the time of darkness. Enduring those dark hours preceding the arrival of the light." Now that's the first statement. It is not the end of the sentence, but in it, as we considered before, it is God's promise to protect those who engage in what he wants done. And that he recognizes that we live in a dark time. And that that his protection needs to continue through the darkness of this time. And then it goes on to say that, you know, he is intending to empower us. The term that he used here suggests that we'll be made ever more in his likeness, which is really the key to doing anything successful, is being empowered by God. This goes on to say, who says, so you'll be made into the image of his life, nourished and blessed by Yahweh, who says, Yahweh, or who says to approach Yahweh, my trusted place, my refuge, my stronghold, my God, is the steadfast and constant one. In him I continually trust and rely. The key to being where Yahweh would like us to be is not just knowing his name, but knowing that what he has said is reliable because it never changes. And if we trust and rely on that which is trustworthy, then we will be right where he would like us to be, right where we should be. But now, that is, of course, a death knell to the religion that I was called to critique, as well as the one that I subsequently exposed and condemned a number of years later. If God is steadfast and constant, as this is saying, Eloah, that he is Natosh, permanent, perpetual, imminent, continuous, and truthful, dependable, and steadfast, that means that there can be no Quran. Because why? The Quran says that it confirms the Torah. That's laughable. It repudiates all of it and comes up with an entirely different and completely despicable message. It's literally the antithesis of the Torah. Well, it's not possible if God is consistent and dependable. And particularly in Islam's case, because Allah claims to be the God who inspired the Torah, which makes him an absolute laughingstock. You have to be an absolute ignoramus under these conditions to be a Muslim, to believe Islam, to consider it to be worthy. But the same thing would be true with the Christian New Testament. There can't be a New Testament that is different than the Old Testament if, in fact, God is consistent. And it further undermines the whole concept of a belief system. Religions are belief systems. They are based entirely on faith. Doubt is considered to be the enemy. You are told to believe. Now, you're not given any evidence, not any reasons to believe, only told that you must believe. You can read Paul's letters 1,000 times. You won't find anything in Paul's letters that would give you any credence, any confidence. You cannot know when there is no evidence. And so with religion, it is strictly a matter of beliefs. And yet here Yahweh said, because I am steadfast and truthful, you can trust and rely upon me. Now, trust is based on knowing. Reliance is based on understanding. When belief is necessary, trust and reliance are impossible.
Yeah. How could anyone have confidence in somebody you don't know anything about them? And you have no proof that they can fulfill the contract.
You know, if you read Paul's letters, he tells you nothing about his God. Nothing. He never quotes Yahweh accurately. He never once quotes Yahusha. The one time he made a lame attempt to quote Yahusha out of context, I mean, he completely butchered the quote. I mean, there's just no semblance between what he said and what Yahusha said. So if you're going to create a caricature of God that models the image that you have of him, the real God can't be known. Now, in the case of Islam, there's a fair amount said about Allah, although the Quran specifically says that Allah cannot be known. So there you have it. And what little is said about Allah is depicts him in hell, torturing those who didn't submit to him. So he is depicted exactly as you would expect Satan.
So the fair assumption is that, and a lot of what the Knight for Some is saying here is that, from what we've come to know, is that the shelter of Yah and his shadow is a place of enlightenment. And
yes.
Understanding. I would like to just mention this, something that...
A place you enter through trust and reliance.
Yeah, a place you know. You don't have to go in with your eyes closed and hope for the best. But, one thing jumped out at me in Genesis. One thing I like about, Bereshit.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Bereshit tends to be, it's sort of the starting place, and then you can see echoes of it throughout the Torah, right? One thing that jumped out at me was when man first was nourished by knowledge of good and evil. Mm-hmm. When they ate of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that jumped out at me is that he said that he heard the voice of Yah and he was afraid, and he hid himself. And I think that sums up what religion really is. It's a man's response to God in a state of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at all these dominating religions, that's always a theme. There's a fear of God.
Yeah. Of course, when Adam and Chawa were with Yahweh in the garden prior to being hoodwinked by Satan, and as Roy has written me in previous occasions, and I've tried to include this in one of the most recent chapters, Satan did not come into the garden as a snake. He left as a snake. He did not come in that way. He came in glowing, beautiful. He would have been as beautiful as anything in the garden, maybe more beautiful than any garden. And he didn't come in with an alternative plan. He didn't come in saying, hello, I'm Satan. I'm known as the adversary. This is who I really am. and what I want you to do is I want you to worship me. No, no, he knew Yahweh. He misquoted Yahweh, but he based his story on Yahweh's testimony taken out of context, truncated and twisted, to derive a misunderstanding, to yield a misunderstanding, which is exactly what Pauline doctrine does. That's Galatians is written exactly in the manner that Satan fooled Adam and Chawa. Now, the thing that's interesting is that Satan would have come into the garden exactly as Satan appeared to Paul as flashing rays of light on the road to Damascus. And when there was no apple, there's no mention of an apple. It's as big a corruption, well, not as big a corruption as the name Eve, which is the name of a pagan sun goddess. It's Chawa. But the fruit, that which provides nourishment of the knowledge of good and evil, means that man now knew bad. He knew what was errant, what was lifeless, what was wrong, he now was aware of what was religious, what was political, what was militaristic, what was, it wasn't just now man and Yahweh, man, woman, and Yahweh. Now it was all of the nastiness that permeates the world. And so they were now in a position where they would constantly have to choose one or the other. Free will would now prevail, as it did even in the choice to consume the fruit. But now they were aware of what was wrong. And
it says, too, that they knew that they were naked.
Yeah, and the naked was strictly that. And this is one of the things that I find fascinating. If you look at both Islam and Pauline Christianity, women have to cover themselves up. And Paul really disliked women. He was extraordinarily demeaning to women, as was Muhammad. Muhammad hated women. His harem was not a collection of wives that he loved, but instead a collection of women that he had absolute control over and that he could abuse. There were rape victims and pedophile victims that were part of his harem, but he made them cover up. When God was with Adam and Chawa, they didn't need clothing. They're beautiful. God doesn't think there's anything wrong with the human body. Nothing at all.
They weren't suddenly they became self-conscious or they became ashamed of their.
They became ashamed of who they had become. And so they.
I just thought it was interesting that, like, religion, they all have the same symptoms, being that they really do have a fear of God, and that's right there at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, it's like they needed to hide from God.
Right.
Yeah, they had something they needed to hide from God. Well, before they had the knowledge of good and evil, there was nothing they needed to hide from God or from one another.
So religion is a shelter for them, but it's a shelter from God.
Correct.
Another thought. Let me throw at you is Yahweh always encourages you to scrutinize what he says, his claims. I mean, obviously Adam and Chawa talk to him all the time and say, "Well, what about that? What's this? And such and such and such." The Lords, all these gods that man makes or Satan becomes, they require total faith. They don't take questioning. That's why we've lost so many Christian fans. If we talk to them about what y'all really said, they view us as a threat.
Right. Yeah.
Because I say, well, let's scrutinize it together. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But that doesn't satisfy them. They just get away.
Yeah, the Quran in the last lines of the fifth surah, which was the last that was revealed chronologically, says those who question the Quran lose their faith. And indeed, anyone who looks at the Quran with a questioning mind will lose their faith in Islam. It's the dumbest and worst book and the most immoral, bloodthirsty, terrorist dogma ever written. And it's repulsive from beginning to end. And so, that's if you're not willing to question. Now, I'm going to tell you that I think there is a 0% possibility that Adam and Chawa didn't have a conversation with Yahweh about the two trees in the center of the garden. And say, okay, you got those trees there. Why are those trees there? Why are there instructions on those trees and nothing else in the garden? They had that discussion. And I'm certain Yahweh would have said to them that you need to have the opportunity to rebel, to reject me. I want to have a relationship with you. I want it to be mutually beneficial. I want it to be mutually enjoyable. And the only way to accomplish that is for you to have the choice to disengage in a relationship.
And in a sense, would the relationship be as significant if there wasn't that knowledge of evil, like if there wasn't that separation and then the reconciliation afterwards? Is more meaningful in that way?
I think so.
I would say so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think when you know the alternative, the relationship becomes more meaningful. I think the Torah is more meaningful because it shows both sides. I don't know what the consequence is of choosing religion and what the benefits are of choosing a relationship. I think that it is absolutely beneficial to know both sides. So then this goes on to say, surely he will defend, extricate, and deliver you from the contrived plots and the entrapment leading to be under the control of those who bait their traps to entice, luring their prey from the epidemic and deadly plague of written and spoken declarations of destructive and malicious threats. Well, this has really two levels of insight. The first is that I was looking just to have my home be a safe sanctuary. And the first line resolves that. This says that that if you're going to do something that Yahweh wants done, then he's going to defend us. He's going to deliver us from personal attack. And in the case of Islam, if you're going to expose and condemn it, you are going to have people who conspire to trap you, people who conspire to control you. They're going to scheme against you. And you're going to find people by the hundreds of thousands doing this. And you'll even find, if you expose Islam, not if you expose Christianity, but certainly if you expose Islam, the politically correct amongst secular socialist humanists, they will be strategizing to demean you, setting a trap for you. And what's interesting here is that with both, their initial onslaught is a war of words. It's a deadly spoken and written declarations, destructive and malicious threats. You know, I don't think that I ever had anyone who was a Muslim write me and say, you know, I think you made your best effort here. And boy, you know, this is a 1,000-page analysis, Prophet of Doom. And, you know, it is extraordinarily well documented. And, you know, it was a masterful job taking the Quran and rearranging it chronologically so that you could put it into the context of Muhammad's life. But I think that you erred in the following ways. But otherwise, I think you meant well. You just you came to an invalid conclusion here, there, and the other place by the fact you didn't consider such and such. Never once. Now I had hundreds of thousands of letters from Muslims around the world. No, every one of them began the same way. Using language that isn't fit for any program anywhere. It's not even fit for the human mouth. And so they were all vicious threats, most of them talking about the relative morality of my mother. And then they would go from these malicious threats, slander, if you will. And then most of it was trying to be demeaning. They would call me Jewish. I wish I was. I'm not. You know, I'm Sioux Indian and Irish. But I'm not. That I was money grubbing, doing it for money, and I've lost money on this enterprise. I give the books away free. And they would say that, you know, you really you know that Islam is true, so why would you, you know, write such a thing? Well, if I knew it was true, I certainly wouldn't write this. And then, you know, they'd call you an Islamophobe, and you say, wait a minute, how can I be afraid of Islam if I have the courage to expose and condemn it? You know, but it was all just vicious slander, destructive, malicious slander. And the you know, the 20 or so people out of thousands who would say, you know, you translated this incorrectly. You know, you'd go through and say, no, here's, I appreciate you bringing that up, but let's go through it. Here's the five most popular translations, and here's what they say. So, no, I didn't mistranslate it. And then they'd, you'd hear the slander, well, you know, you don't speak Arabic, so there's no way for you to know.
Hmm.
Well, then what about this issue? The first is that that the Quran really isn't written in Arabic. The Arabic alphabet is Hebrew. Same number of letters. They are the same letters. Same vowels, same consonants. It's the same alphabet. And most of the words in Arabic are actually Hebrew words, including Quran. Quran is from the Hebrew kara, with the exact same meaning, to read and to recite. So if you don't know Hebrew, you're in a position where you probably wouldn't know the Quran. But that would also be the argument of saying, you want to tell me that Arabic is a language so impoverished that it's the only language in the world that can't be translated into English or any other language? It's the only language in the world that is so impoverished that it only has meaning in Arabic and no other language. So it was a war of words.
Yeah, plus if there was holes in Prophet of Doom, I mean, you have IQ that was on Shattering Mist many times too, you know, and he speaks the language.
Yeah, IQ.
You know, the fact is that I used the five most popular Quran translations and blended them to create the Prophet of Doom translation. So it's the claim is invalid. In fact, in the course of the 10 years that I used to respond to emails from Prophet of Doom, I haven't been there in over 5 years now, there wasn't a single complaint that was valid. Not one. Now, this is a 1,000-page book. You would expect to have gotten some things wrong. It's a 1,000-page book. There wasn't a single meaningful complaint about a translation that was actually valid in all of those years and all of that that time. Now, the second aspect of this particular passage that strikes home with me is that all religion really is destructive, deadly, epidemic, and slanderous words. Religion is a long diatribe of maliciousness. And it is based upon the ruinous, spiteful, malevolent, mischievous, calamitous yearnings of those who conceive religions and promote them. That's what religion is. You know, if you are the least bit open-minded, rational, and informed, and you read the Christian New Testament, particularly Paul's letters, and you compare them to the God he claims inspired him, the God who Yosha said that he represented, they are the antithesis of one another. They're exact opposites. They both can't be true.